Your weekly pulse on the Milwaukee Bucks, straight from a Bucks legend. This is Here District with Marcus Johnson, alongside his son and 1995 NCAA champion, Chris. Here's MJ.
All right, welcome everybody. I am the captain of this vessel. It's the Fantastic Voyage. It's Here District, your favorite podcast. I'm Marcus Johnson. It's my son, Chris Johnson. We are the only two, the only combination, I should say, father and son that have won a national championship, NCAA national championship. So wait a minute, you're going to be like, aha, wait a minute. There's been Mike Bibby and Henry Bibby. There's been Scott May and Sean May. No. We are the only two that have won it at the same school, UCLA. So that's our claim to fame. But Chris, where can the people hear us?
Well, you can check us out. All of our episodes are on YouTube. The Milwaukee Bucks YouTube channel. Check us out under the podcast tab, or you can subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right. So now our next guest, when it was confirmed that we were able to get him on Here District, I mean, you just wouldn't believe how excited everybody got. I mean, Monas and Dylan and Chris and everybody. And then I remember this guy from way back in the day covering Shaq and Kobe for the Daily News. But Howard Beck, senior staff writer for The Ringer, co-host of Real Ones, a podcast with Raja Bell and Logan Murdoch. We welcome you to Here District, man. Thank you so much for joining us.
Gentlemen, very honored to join the greatest father-son NBA podcasting duo with championships and trophies that cannot be equaled by anybody else. It's awesome. Thank you. Thank you.
Chris, are we the only father and son podcasting duo?
Nah, I'm not sure. We can't. Yeah,
we got to check that out.
Decorated. Yeah. The only ones in Milwaukee. I don't know.
Well, the only two that finished in the top 25 after 4 years at UCLA at all-time scoring.
There you go.
That's definitely a standout. But listen, Howard, so like I mentioned, you covered the Lakers. You covered Shaq. I mean, how much did that experience light your passion, or what was that about? Maybe you had to relight your passion after that experience. I don't know, but how was that experience for you? Take us back through those years. Trek through memory lane for us.
It's funny because, you know, fans always, when people ask me about that time, like, how amazing was that, right? 7 years of covering Shaq and Kobe and three-peat and all of this and, you know, four finals in 5 years and all this. And it's like, oh yeah, that's right. They were pretty good. And it's funny because in the moment when you're covering a team of that intensity level, you recognize the great basketball and the history unfolding before your eyes. And right. I spent obviously hours and days and weeks and months writing about it. But you are along for the ride, and it is very, because of the job, the nature of newspapers, which is where I was doing it for at the time, the LA Daily News. It's always just there's a deadline to meet, right? I got a game to cover. I got a deadline to hit. Shaq and Kobe are fighting today. All right, here we go again. I got to write one of those again. The roller coaster of that team, the fans experience it as the roller coaster of the wins and the losses, the feuds, everything else. I'm experiencing it as, it's just nonstop. So I think I actually appreciate it much more now in retrospect than I probably did during that 7 year span where I was just trying not to lose my mind and make deadline as much as I can, you know, but it was a formative experience, Marcus, like to your question, like I grew up in the Bay Area as a huge Niners fan in the 80s during the Joe Montana era, right? Like that was the Niners dynasty, like that. Everybody's got their formative moment. If you're a sports fan or a sports media member, there's a team or a figure, a player, a moment that captured you, that captivated you, and that like made you want to do more of this. I want to watch more games. I want to be a season ticket holder. I want to be a player. I want to be a coach. Or in my case, I want to be a reporter who covers sports. I want to do this for a living. The Niners were my entry point, right? That was the team that hooked me. And then I go to college and I worked for the college newspaper and I put everything into this because that was the career I wanted, believing as a passionate Niners fan and as an NFL fan, that that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be an NFL beat writer. And, you know, life happens, right? You take the opportunities where they come and you also at some point realize, oh yeah, to be a professional journalist means to do away with your fandom anyway. And I did that a long time ago, made that transition. And then the NBA, you know, without getting into the weeds about how I ended up covering the Lakers starting in 97, like that happened and the NBA wasn't the goal, but it's become my career, my life, the most formative thing that's probably happened to me. Like it's you know, without it, like I'm not in New York for the last 20 years without this. There's all these, you know, people I've met and incredible experiences I've had that are all because of this, but there's a happenstance element, you know, you choose the path to an extent, but the universe kind of shapes it for you.
Yeah. And that's interesting with the Niners. And I'm not going to get too far into weeds on this, but one of my really good friends, middle school, Crenshaw High School, UCLA, Wendell Tyler, got traded from the Rams to the Niners.
Remember
great,
him well.
Great running back, Super Bowl champion. He talked about just how first class that organization was. He couldn't believe the night and day difference between that organization and the Rams. Bigger jet, owned seats, not a lot of smoking on the plane, like on the Rams plane, which is full of cigarette smoke. And just talked about, you know, Eddie DiBartolo, and just the whole situation up there was just a first class experience. So when you talked about, and then my point was that Joe Montana, when it was like, I was like, what kind of guy was he? I wrote a book about Crenshaw luminaries, and he was one of the guys I interviewed. And he talked about Joe Montana was a guy, Howard, that you could take to the hoodiest of hoods or the most aristocrat of dinner parties, and he would fit right in both places. He's just like, he was like a salt of the earth type guy, and I kind of felt that. Where I did a LA Gear commercial with him and Keem and some other guys, about kind of a play on White Man Can't Jump.
You remember?
Yeah. Yeah. No. I was about to say, love that commercial. I feel like I'm the only one who remembers the one like, hey, kid, can you pass? Like, yeah, I can pass.
Got the hat on, got his hat on backwards. Yeah, I can pass. Yeah. So we spent a day on the set. So anyway,
love that commercial. I'm sorry, Marcus. I'd forgotten that you were involved in that. Think of it as the Joe Montana LA Gear commercial. So,
that was great. It was just fantastic. Great being around and great meeting him. But anyway, just it was always good when you hear like guys that you really respect, like Joe Montana, from me growing up, that you hear that there's just as good of people, you know, off the field as they're on the field. So that was good stuff to hear. Absolutely. All right, man. So let's talk about these Bucks. You came out, I think, a week or so ago and said that this was kind of the surprise team, the team that you thought, not surprised, but maybe doing a little better than what was initially anticipated. Now that was, you know,
a week ago.
We always talk about aging well. No Giannis, no Kevin Porter Jr., but the Giannis absence, Doc Rivers, Howard Christie, he talks about a silver lining. I mean, do you feel like, Howard, that this is an opportunity? I know it's an opportunity, but do you think that this team can withstand the absence of these two for a 2-week stretch with the Pistons, Blazers, Heat, Knicks, Nets, Wizards, and then Pistons, Sixers coming up? I mean, God, how important is it just to be respectable in this little run right here?
It's a tough stretch. And, you know, Doc is saying what he has to say, right? And look, there's always truth in coach speak, but it is very much coach speak to say, well, other guys got to step up. This is an opportunity for guys. And it is like, it's important, especially when you have a couple of young guys like Rollins and Green, where, okay, you know what? We need you this much more now. Can this be a growing experience? Can they, you know, push their games a little bit, push the envelope, and, you know, have them be that much better when he comes back? Sure. But I think some teams can weather these kinds of situations better than others. It would be nice if they had a little bit more depth and a little bit more playmaking and not have to go like, I mean, it's amazing. We've gone from, because, you know, life comes at you fast in the NBA, right? Yeah. A week ago or a couple weeks, whenever, I was probably saying like, this is one of the teams that's really come out of the gates hot and exceeding expectations a little bit. But so much of that had to do with Ryan Rollins suddenly turning into like not just a player, but a really impactful player, a really steady and consistent one out of basically nowhere. Like almost nobody saw this coming. And that's a bonus when he's next to Giannis and you can benefit from the fact that this is all just additive. When there's no Giannis and suddenly the best thing you have going for you offensively is Ryan Rollins, that's a whole different situation. And I'm not saying he can't handle it, but I am saying that's a lot to put on a young guy who 5 minutes ago was on a two-way contract and had been cut by a couple of teams before finding his place with the Bucks, right? And he's one of the great stories of the season right now. I love what he's done, and he's been really fun to watch. But, you know, to be a primary ball handler, playmaker for a team with some level of expectations and have to kind of hold it together as a young player, without Giannis for a bit here, That's tough, but you know what? That's one of the curiosities, right? Let's see how well he responds.
Well, he's a fantastic voice. Go ahead, Chris.
Do you think, but in your heart of hearts, from what you've seen out of Rollins this season, for me, over the summer on this very podcast, I said if he got the minutes, he could be a potentially a most improved player. Do you think that this sort of run he's been on production wise is sustainable during these next 2 weeks? And like when Giannis is out, like your honest assessment, or do you think like this gauntlet is going to kind of give him a hard time?
He's going to get, Chris, obviously a lot more of the focus of the defense now, right? Like that's the toughest thing. When you're playing off of Giannis, you know that all eyes are on Giannis at all times and you can find your way around that. But look, he's got an NBA body. He is sturdy. He's strong. He's athletic. He plays really steady. He plays more like a vet. And so I think he can handle it, but I think the question is going to be when the defense, you know, when they're drawing up game plans and they're taking the court and they're looking around, who else are they going to focus on now, right? And this is no disrespect to the rest of that Bucks roster, but there's nobody else you're really worried about or fearing, especially with the ball in their hands. So how he handles that is going to be key. And I think, you know, with young players, especially a young player who's a primary ball handler, there's always this careful balance between playmaking and shooting, right? Looking for your teammates versus looking for yourself, knowing when to move the ball, when to push the envelope. And that's difficult. He's going to have a lot on him and a lot of expectations, but you don't want him to try to overdo it either, because then he's going to be, you know, dribbling into traffic and turning the ball over or forcing up bad shots. You don't want that either, right? You always hear the, stay aggressive, stay aggressive. Yeah. Okay. Stay aggressive, but stay under control. Stay aggressive, but make the right play.
Right.
And so that's the test for him in this next stretch of games.
And to make matters worse, I mean, this team was put together as a bunch of catch and shoot guys.
Yeah.
Not, as you just mentioned, create my own shot, break you down off the dribble. The Bucks are 23rd in terms of ISO efficiency. I mean, no, Kyle Kuzma's about the best outside of Ryan Rollins. He's in the 45th percentile if you look at the numbers in terms of what he does efficiency-wise. I mean, my point – when this thing breaks down, it doesn't look – there's a look to it, Chris Howard, that this – it's I won't say eyesore basketball, but it's just not – it's not good to look at. And that's because it was designed to have guys who could play off of Giannis as the heliocentric focal point, everything going through him. When he's not there, now this thing really kind of gets exposed. So that's what Doc is – that's a job that I don't envy with Doc, just trying to figure out how to make this thing flow. But Doc keeps saying, Howard, that something's going to emerge. Somebody's got to figure something out. Something's going to – why are you shaking your head, Chris? Something's going to happen.
Who? You know what I mean?
Like, yeah, go ahead.
Well, my point, guys, Gary Trent, you know, he's kind of – hasn't really found his groove. I mean, he did – like coming off that series against Indiana last year, I kind of felt like he was going to come into this season kind of, you know, extremely locked in, ready to step up, ready to take sort of another jump. For me, he's sort of been the guy that of all the guys, you know, on the roster, he's kind of that other guy. I felt like 15 to 17 points a game would have been reasonable for him. He's kind of underachieving on that level, and it's making things tough on the Bucks as a total offensive unit. But I think the biggest thing we're talking about, you know, the offensive side of things, but guys, the defensive side of things, I mean, that's where the Bucks really the bane of the Bucks' existence has been, is on the defensive end this year.
Yeah, and the thing is too, like we go back to like the Ryan Rollins aspect of this, that he's such a great story. Like that dude defends his butt off, right? And we know that Giannis is an elite defender and can anchor a defensive scheme. Miles Turner's obviously a very accomplished shot blocker. Kuzma, once upon a time, was a very good defender, I thought, in LA when he won a championship out there. And I feel like you guys tell me, because you've seen more of the Bucks this season than I have. I've watched a fair amount, but Kuzma looks like he is playing a lot harder now than even when he arrived in Milwaukee in the middle of last season. Like, I feel like we're starting to see a little bit more of the version when he was younger, when he was, I think, playing a more serious game. And look, in his defense, kind of. It's hard to be a real serious player when you're playing for a team that is as just messed up as the Wizards were, and they're in a tear down. They're just like, at some point you're just going for your own numbers, right? And you're not, we I know we're not winning. Why am I going to bust my ass defensively? We're not going to be a good defensive team. And so you lose all the discipline that you had early in your career in his case. And, but that player still exists, right? His body hasn't broken down. Like, that skill set, that athleticism, that ability is still there. And I do feel like I've seen more, you tell me, I feel like I've seen more of Kuzma, like, you know, playing hard on defense again, trying a little, being a little bit more of a disciplined player the last couple of weeks, or I should say this season, than when he first got to Milwaukee last season.
Yeah, no, he had a big 29-point game, scored 20, two or three times this year, 17 the other night, last night against the Sixers. I mean, he's starting to rediscover, you know, that, like you said, that aspect of his game. And even with the Wizards losing teams and all that, get my own and all that. But he had a couple of seasons where he was 22, 23 points a game. Sure. And in this league, when you can do that and you're on a bad team and other teams can focus on you more defensively because you don't have that kind of talent around. I mean, that's nothing to sneeze at. And I'm not saying that he can bring it back up to that level, but If the Bucks can get 16 to 19 from him, I mean, I think they'd be ecstatic on a nightly basis. Chris?
Kuz has done a great job just refining his shot diet. It's less about the threes and the PG, you know, off the dribble package, doing step backs. And now he's getting easy buckets. He's trying to hit the offensive glass. He's attacking the rim at a much higher rate. And then he's taking that open three with a lot of confidence when he does take it. But that's what I like the most out of Kuz. We talked to his trainer, Howard, in the offseason, the guy that's been with him since his days at Utah, guy by the name of Clint Parks. And he talked about just how their focus this offseason was getting back to what you talked about, the stuff that made him a dog for the Lakers, the intangibles, right? Yeah. The glass, rebounding, running hard, you know, showing a value on the floor outside of just getting buckets. But yeah, but to your point, Kuz has been awesome. Hopefully he can continue to leverage that.
Yeah, and getting downhill, he's doing a much, and that's what Doc has really helped, just kind of narrowing his focus, man. Look, when you catch it, you know, get downhill. Kuz, get downhill, be my playmaker. You know, look to spray it out, blah, blah. So that, I think that it's tough. You know, like you say, you know, you come from the Wizards to a team that's all about Giannis, and everybody has to find their niche around Giannis. Now all of a sudden, you know, you've got to find your space within the confines of that. So it's not as easy as one might think, you know. So yeah. I don't know.
But there's expectations there too. And I think sometimes that's what you need, right? If you're in an environment where there's no expectations, it allows you to drop all the good habits and develop bad habits. And when you're in an environment with higher expectations, and the Bucks obviously have aspirations, you've got, you know, one of the greatest players in the league, a perennial MVP candidate. You can't be, you know, can't be messing around anymore. You got to kind of play a more serious brand of basketball.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, speaking of which, so we talked about, Kevin Porter Jr. Are you a fan? You think he, when he comes back, is he the answer? How much of the Bucks fans hope should they pin on the return of KPJ?
Look, if there's one thing that covering this league for, hard to believe, 29, this is my 29th season. If there's one thing that it's taught me, it's that we are sometimes too swift to judge players. I'm not even touching like the off-court stuff, but I mean, sometimes too swift to judge players as players. For what they're missing when they come in, or lack of discipline, whatever it may be. And some figure it out and some don't. So I'm not going to say that like there's not a possible, like the guy has incredible natural ability, right? And we saw that. We saw his explosiveness in Houston and in Cleveland. But like there's a good player in there somewhere, a consistent player, a productive player. There's a big, you know, you guys know this better than I do. There is a difference between being a talented player and being a good player. A lot of guys have talent, but are you channeling it in the right way? And are you channeling it in a way that helps your team win? Yeah. And so there's an outline there. There's a skill set there. Sure. You got to harness it. And it's unfortunate he's been hurt and we can't see it. I mean, listen, I was at the press conference in Vegas in July when they introduced Miles Turner. And, you know, that was obviously a pretty big news-making week for the Bucks to have cut loose Dame, waved and stretched him. You know, there's great risk to that with regard to your salary cap. And they use that space to go out and get Miles Turner, which, okay, great. You needed somebody to replace Brook Lopez. You needed a younger version of that. That's fine. But my question for the Bucks then was like, okay, but how are you replacing Dame? And I don't even just mean as having a second star. I mean as having somebody else who can do something with the ball in their hands. And the response I got was basically, this is about Giannis. Giannis is going to have the ball in his hands. We're, you know, this is point Giannis. This is Giannis's universe, and everybody else will play off that. And I said, okay, well, let's see, because I wasn't sold on the idea of Kevin Porter Jr. being the answer there. They've, you know, tried rotated various other guys, you know, through that spot. And when the season began, it was that outline of an offense was actually looking pretty good, because Giannis can create, you know, a lot for everybody and is a great distributor. And as long as you've got capable shooters around him, and then suddenly the Ryan Rollins emergence, okay, cool. Now this starts to make more sense to me. I still think you could use one more guy at that spot, and I don't think that Kevin Porter Jr. is necessarily the answer to that question, but we'll see once he gets healthy.
Yeah. You think the three-headed approach with Rollins and then Cole Anthony, who's come off the bench and given the Bucks a spark as far as being a creator, a guy that can get downhill, get his own shot, and plays with a spark. Do you think that approach, because I go back to what you had said about how their expectations, and with the expectations, and that made me think about culture and how over the summer Doc Rivers was really specific about KPJ and just surrounding him with love, how the Bucks culture was going to try to nurture and this and that. And so when you talked about Dame and replacing Dame, all those kind of factors I threw into that hat and just a quick kind of just processing thought process. Do you think, or are you totally out on KPJ, despite what you saw in the beginning of the season with him running the point? Do you think that it's still a possibility that KPJ can turn into something?
I will always say it's a possibility, right? It's not something I would bank on. And I don't know that I would want to bet my future as an organization on it. And look, there's always a Giannis factor here too. I know Bucks fans hate to hear it, and they hate when people like me and the national media bring it up. But like, every move you make has a potential ripple effect on Giannis's future, the short term and the longer term here. And so every bet you make on a player, and especially one who's coming in with obviously a kind of checkered resume like Kevin Porter Jr., you better be right. Because if you're wrong, it's not just affecting your win-loss ledger, it may be affecting the entire future of your franchise, right? But this is a league of you know, opportunism, where you have to just take the swings that present themselves, right? Ryan Rollins is a phenomenal story, and the Bucks deserve all the credit in the world right now for the way he's playing and the player that he has become so far and can still become. Like, there's a lot of evolution left there probably for Ryan Rollins. But his... you know, getting that out of a guy who was, again, a two-way player, you know, less than whatever, 6 months ago, is a huge benefit. But that's what you have to do, right? One of these guys you have to hit on, right? We'll take a swing at a Ryan Rollins, who got cut by two other teams. We'll take a swing at Kevin Porter Jr., who's been, you know, bounced around a little bit, has great potential, but, and as long as one of those guys, or hopefully multiple of them, hit, you're okay. And I think, Ryan Rollins has bought them a lot of latitude now. And I think the Bucks at full strength, you know, they're that much more viable this season. And the East, you know, we keep saying it's wide open. I'm not sure how wide open. Like, Detroit's now emerged. I'm not sure I buy Toronto as a contender, but like, Detroit deserves to be talked about with Cleveland and New York now. And you know, when the season started, I thought the Pistons would be a top four team in the East. I didn't think they'd be leading the East. And I thought some combination of the Bucks, the Sixers, in the best, most optimistic version of the Sixers, could crack that top four too. A lot of other people were very high on Orlando and Atlanta. They've both had up and down seasons. Obviously, Banchero's been out. Trae Young's been out. There's still quite a bit of jockeying going on. I don't think we have a clear pecking order, and we shouldn't, right? We're not even at the 20 game mark yet.
Yeah. And speaking of KPJ, so when he returns, there was some question as to whether or not, you know, he'd be a starter, how Doc was going to handle that. I just don't think there's any way in the world you can take Ryan Rollins, Chris Howard, out of the starting lineup right now. Everything that he's meant, everything he's done, just his whole just the energy that he brings to the table. It's starter energy. You know what I mean? Before, yeah, it was like you could plug and play, put him in for one of the two guards. And right now, I just can't see him coming off the bench. So I don't know. I just want to throw that out there that he's earned himself a starting position and stay in the starting lineup, but we'll see how Doc plays it out. So, Howard, I know you got to get out of here, but before we let you go, let's go around the league, talk about some other stuff that's going on. I don't know. You tell me where you want to. The Nico stuff in Dallas, that's kind of played out a little bit, I think, unless you've got some illuminating insights you'd love to share on that.
I think everybody wishes we could illuminate a little bit more about what the hell happened in Dallas. There's no illumination. It's just darkness. It's bleak.
Yeah.
I mean, listen, at least they have Cooper Flagg, but yeah, I mean, that was a necessary move. They did what they had to do. It was probably overdue. I never wish that on anybody. I never root for people to be fired. I never advocate for that, in my role, but sometimes you see the writing on the wall and you think like, I don't see how this is tenable. And it wasn't. But yeah, it's interesting. Like there's this early part of the season, you're always looking at, who is, overachieving, who's underachieving. Yeah. Is there enough time left to right the ship? That kind of stuff. Like I'm stunned by how bad the Clippers have been.
Yeah.
I'm not surprised by how bad the Kings have been, although they may be even exceeding my low expectations for them. The Grizzlies are a mess. And so then, it all leads you into as we near December, where, December 15th is kind of our unofficial opening of the trade market. We're already all kind of looking at like, all right, we've got this point guard triumvirate. Is it time to move off of Ja Morant? Yeah. Are the Hawks going to move Trae Young, who is potentially a free agent next summer? We got the LaMelo Ball rumor reported by Yahoo Sports yesterday. Back to Dallas, Anthony Davis, is he potentially on the move? The Warriors have a Jonathan Kuminga situation to kind of figure out in the next couple of months. So, are the Jazz holding on to Lauri Markkanen, right? Yeah, like there's a lot of interesting kind of subplots already kind of taking shape.
So in the Eastern Conference, I mean, if you had to pick one of these teams or a couple of these teams that won't be there at the end, I mean, the Bulls have played well, big upset recently on the road someplace, I forget where. I've heard you talk about the Hawks kind of, underachieving, but between the Bulls, Hawks, Sixers, and Heat, I mean, who do you think has the opportunity to have the most staying power between those?
Bulls, Hawks, Sixers. I'm not sold on the Bulls. I like what they've done so far, and Giddey's been fantastic, and we all love Matas Bezelis, but he's still kind of growing. Yep. So I was not sold on the Bulls despite the fast start. The Hawks, once they get Trae Young back, will be interesting. I think one of the things in this league, when you are a ball dominant guard as Trae Young is, and a guy who by reputation has been difficult for a lot of guys to play with, and you're out for a while, if the team kind of, really stumbles without you, then it's like, look how much you guys need me. suddenly you miss me. If they succeed without you.
Yeah.
Then it's are you recognizing what is working without you? And are you willing to kind of comport yourself and fit back into that? And it's been a mixed bag without him so far, but the Hawks are holding tough without him. And, it's like people around the league were telling me when he went down, like, all right, we're going to see. We'll know more about his future with the Hawks over the next few weeks. Because if they lose a lot without him, it means they need to keep him and give him the fat extension that he's going to want next summer. And if they win a lot without him, it's going to give them the license to say it's time to move in a different direction.
Well, Howard, I think the emergence of Jalen Johnson, I think it really created sort of a conundrum down there in Atlanta on who's really, the most important or most valuable player. I know Trey's right there, but when you're looking at this guy and then some of their young bigs, I mean, they're shooting the ball, they're playing better. So you're right. The Hawks are a trip. I wanted to get your take. I wanted to get your take, though, before we let you go, on sort of this trend league-wide that we're seeing with the injuries. We've heard plenty of people commenting on it. Steve Kerr came out and said something about pace of play. My dad and I have made, we've talked about it at length, how back in the day, centers didn't necessarily have to go out and close out so many times to other shooting to the three-point line, if you will, sort of like Wimby has to do and all these guys. Do you think that pace of play has a direct pace of play and then all the cramming of games and the scheduling? Do you think that has a direct correlation with all the injuries? Is it something else? Or I just wanted to get your opinion on that.
Yeah, I mean, listen, obviously none of us are orthopedists or trainers or medical experts, but part of the job is to talk to those people. And I think I would say the same thing to you today that Steve Kerr, obviously, because he talks to his medical people all the time. And, you know, when you have conversations with people around the league who are specialists in this, this is the outline of it that you get. Yes, it's about pace of play. Yes, it's about the court being spread and guys having to cover more ground. Yes, it's about many more miles per game now than they were playing back in the 90s because of the pace of the game and because of how spread the court is. And then there's the other factor, which my buddy Baxter Holmes over at ESPN wrote a great two-part series like 6 years ago that is still, if not as relevant, more relevant today than it was at the time that he wrote it, which was about just the toll that AAU ball takes on guys, that by the time they get to the NBA, they're just more vulnerable to all these soft tissue injuries because of all the miles logged and all the wear and tear, the specialization. This is a really big issue for the NBA. Like, I know there's this like reductive version of this where people say, oh, it's just about load management. We don't need load management. This is, you know, the analytics guys have gone too far. The sports science guys have gone too far. Or today's players are soft and all that kind of BS. It's not about that. It's about all these other things that we just discussed. And it's a much bigger issue for the NBA to try to wrap its arms around and try to solve, because it's not just about what's happening in the NBA. It's about everything that happens to these players before they've ever arrived. Mm. You can't fix that part. I mean, you can try to work with youth basketball, yeah, and other organizations around the country to try to do something about that. But yeah, as an NBA matter, once they get here, this is where their bodies are. It is difficult. It is tough. This early in the season, I mean, I did it on our podcast on The Real Ones earlier this week. I ran down the list of guys who either started the season already out or got hurt in the last few weeks. And just the number of big names, it's depressing. And it is tough for the league. You don't want to see anybody injured, but especially with stars, this is a star-driven league. Stars drive ratings. Stars drive interest. You need Giannis playing, you need Tyrese Halliburton and Jason Tatum playing. I don't know what the answer to this is. I don't know that Adam Silver knows what the answer to this is, but it is something that the NBA needs to figure out.
What do you think about shortening the season? Is that even something that even will ever get on the table?
If you asked everybody that in absence of the money, massive asterisk off the $10 billion a year that the NBA generates. If it weren't for the money, what's the ideal length of a season? You know, people would vary on the answer, right? 50 games, 60, 66, as they played during the last lockout season, whatever. Almost everybody would tell you, and certainly the trainers and the orthopedists and the researchers and everybody else who pays attention to the health of players and the wear and tear and what fatigue does in terms of making you more vulnerable to injury, they would all say no back-to-backs ever. And by the way, credit to the league. There used to be like average of 17, 18 back-to-backs per team per year. They've ratcheted that down to like 12, 13, 14 because they've gone out of their way to try to make it easier. But when you give a longer All-Star break, as they did about 10 years ago, when you create the NBA Cup, when you do all these other things to the schedule, you still create a situation where there's not enough recovery time. And the only way to ultimately answer that, either lengthen the season, just start that much earlier,
spread it out, right?
Nobody wants to lose their summers and their off seasons, or reduce the number of games. And so we can say that philosophically and functionally reducing the schedule would be the best answer to what we're talking about. And I think you'd get 100% agreement, players, owners, coaches, trainers, everybody. As soon as you say, all right, who's ready to give up, I don't know, fill in the blank, a few hundred million, whatever it is, please, that they're all splitting 50-50, the owners and the players.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then suddenly everybody's not so much in favor of it. So it's almost a moot discussion. Like, we need to keep having the discussion because it's important.
Yeah.
And because that may well be the best answer, but it's almost a moot discussion because nobody ever wants to actually get to the point where, well, then what do we do about the money? And how much are we willing to lose?
Yeah. you know, it'll be interesting to I'd be interesting to find out just what the number of injuries were during that COVID season when we shut down in March and picked back up a month or two later when the guys had a break away from the game. Anyway, yeah. Look, I'm not a doctor, but I did have my dunk shot blocked by one back in the mid 80s. So, Howard Beck, man, look, man, we thank you so much for joining here, District. And you can check out Howard, senior staff writer for The Ringer, co-host of Real Ones, the podcast with Roger Bell and Logan Murdoch, also on The Ringer. Man, thank you so much. And hopefully you'll rejoin us on down the road when things start to crystallize a little bit more. Thank you so much.
Guys, this was a blast. Wonderful doing it with you guys. Really happy to we finally got to make it happen. I've been putting off your producer for a while, trying to figure out the schedule and everything. So glad we could finally do it. And yeah, happy to come back anytime.
All right. Thanks for making the time. Howard Beck. All right. Here, District. Fantastic voyage. Marcus Johnson, Chris Johnson. Want to thank our guest, Howard Beck, for coming on and sharing some of his insights with us. And, man, we were talking about Howard Beck and how he used to write this column, I believe, with the New York Times, Chris. And
yeah.
How he was
big time.
Just he's super plugged dog. In. Yes.
Yeah, he was a top dog, man. His source is where Mac. I mean, it's an honor to really have him. I looked up to that guy for a while. Like, he's dope.
Yeah.
Super dope.
Yeah. And you know, he spoke his truth. He came out and said that he was not a big fan of Kevin Porter Jr. Now, I will say this. And not so much in defense of KPJ, but from what I saw last year, his final 20, 25 games after the All-Star break when the move was made, and then what I saw in training camp and preseason, I think a guy like Kevin Porter Jr., this period of being away from the game, he was away from the game before over in China when he was going through some stuff. Now he's away because of injury. I just think he's going to come back with a higher level of appreciation and feeling needed, feeling wanted, feeling, you know what I mean? Like he's indispensable to this team's success. And for him, that's a good place to be. That's a good place to be.
Absolutely, MJ. Real quickly on that, man. It's some guys, some personalities, some dudes are built a certain way. And KPJ is built that way. He needs to be handled with care.
Yeah.
I do think time away, a little bit of introspection, time to really miss things. I mean, that stuff, you know, might not mess with Giannis or somebody like that, but for KPJ, I think it'll resonate and he'll come back completely locked in.
Yeah, and I always read between the lines some of the things he's been saying. It's hard to be away from my guys. My guys have kept my spirits up. My guys have reached out to me, man. It's been a difficult night being with my guys.
And you know, that's a big deal.
To give it up.
Talking about that really depends on the group, the unit, the brotherhood. See, some people, I don't want to go on a diatribe, but dog, that's a very specific kind of thing, relationship thing within a team that just isn't like normal for all the guys to experience it. Yeah. I think it's a nuanced sort of case by case. Certain guys have a deeper appreciation.
And like Howard Beck said with Trae Young, you know, if the team all of a sudden is doing great, you got to figure out where you fit in. It'd be different if the Bucks were just on this massive roll and they were 14-2 right now over 16 games. You know, it's been a push and pull. There's been a little bit of progress, some setbacks, and so it's not like he's gonna feel like he's needed.
But MJ also we're going on about this, but like that gives me the question, and I just want one more thing on this.
You're all good. Take your time.
So is it crystal clear set because of how well he's been playing that Rollins will continue to be the starter, or is it something that because the Bucks have gone 8-8 with him playing, you know, meaningful minutes, being the starter, playing a primary role on this team, but being a 500 team with him, do you roll the dice and, you know, elevate KPJ back to his rightful place atop, you know, whatever, the proverbial throne of the Bucks starting point guard that he had in the beginning of the season that Doc came out and said and stamped him at the beginning of training camp?
Yeah, I mean it's a tough one. Not necessarily a conundrum for Doc, but it's you got to give a lot of thought to it because, again, I always look at the backstory of these players and Kevin Porter Jr.'s backstory we just touched on, and then Ryan Rollins. Yeah. I mean, just kind of let go by a couple of teams, bouncing around in the minor leagues for a minute, doing his thing, and now all of a sudden he's found this groove, if you will, with the Bucks and playing out of his mind and shooting the ball and D-ing up and doing everything you're asked. And then all of a sudden you tell him, I want you to bring me that off the bench. I just don't know if that's That's a good. That's a great. Great question. That's the main question.
I've been thinking about, but that's what I've been thinking about. Everybody, it seems like it's clear cut that Rollins will stay, but then you jeopardize crushing KPJ's spirit. You don't know how you're going to look schematically on the court. They were looking good with KPJ running the point.
Well, can you start the two of them together and put and maybe put AJ coming off the bench as shooting?
That may be the decision that ultimately gets made.
Yeah, that's the
move. That might be the move.
That's the direction that I'm leaning, just in terms of length and defense and forcing turnovers. I mean,
100%.
You get all that good defense plus the offense that Rollins is bringing plus KPJ's offense too. So, but speaking of which, we're going to take a look at some of these, both the good and bad of the Bucks against the Sixers. And man, that fourth quarter, they were up late, up by two late, had a chance to win that game. And Doc Rivers spoke specifically about execution. And so about that action, we're going to take a look at some good execution. First, the first three plays will be good execution. So, Dylan, let's roll these first three plays. I think we got AJ and Miles on a double slip here. So here's AJ, Miles with the slip. And then that's a great job by Ryan Rollins. He had 14 assists. Take a look again. A lot of this hinges upon Miles' defender, the big right there, as Ryan Rollins comes off the screen. Watch Miles' defender, number 25, go with Ryan Rollins. There's nobody on that backside, and that's a really well-executed play. Any thoughts on that, Chris?
Well, no, you just my thoughts on all of the Bucks' successful offensive plays is continuing to go to the well until someone stops it.
Yeah.
So run that play over and over again until the big actually tips or deflects that lob and you're not getting that play.
Yeah.
That's my only comment about this play and any of the Bucks' successful plays. But this is good stuff because you get Miles involved.
Yeah.
And if in the event that there's a complete breakdown, AJ Green is doing a great job of spacing out, staying behind the three.
Yeah.
So it actually clears out, it gives more space.
Right.
That lob action.
Yeah, you put the defense in a position to, you know, close out on AJ. Stay with AJ, or do I help out tag on Miles? And you see what happens. You get an easy two at the lob. Okay, number two. Got Miles in a corner three off a tough pass from Ryan. That's a nice job. And so now baseline penetration, it's remarkable to me all these years. We said it back in the 70s and 80s that baseline jump shot is going to be open. And Ryan Rollins does a great job, Chris, of extending himself out of bounds. Watch this. He jumps out of bounds to make that pass around the defender. Is that Barlow, number 25, I believe, from Philadelphia?
Yeah, Dominique Barlow. That's Todd. That's Todd's client.
Yeah. That's just a great job by Ryan Rollins. Again, 14 assists, a career high from him.
Yeah.
And
you like Rollins. You like Rollins just in this game, just – he did it in such a diverse – his 14 assists came in such a diverse fashion as far as how he distributed the ball, who he distributed to. And for me, like, you know, that opens up all sides of the floor when he plays that style of game. I love him keeping Miles Turner involved so that Miles can take high percentage looks. Like, the thing at the top of the key is cool. Miles has hit a couple of shots from there, but he seems way more comfortable – in that small little space in the corner, whether or not he's taking the catch and shoot three or operating like he just did there with the little light step back, hard pound dribble. And just, he seems very comfortable. He's done that on the other side of the floor as well.
Yeah. And that's the thing with Miles, and I'm kind of looking up right here. Let me see if these numbers have held up. Like you're saying, your point is very well taken. You've got to find his sweet spots on the floor. And so Miles, as a corner three-point shooter, I know his numbers were off the hook. They're even better now. They were like 55% like a week ago.
He's at
59% of his corner. He's hit 10 of 17 corner three-point shots. So above the break, he's doing okay above the break. He's at 40% or 43% overall on all threes, which is outstanding for a big. I mean, especially the way he started. Kind of missing a lot of those open threes, but now big man is finding his groove. And I don't like it when you know, you put him in a position where you give it to him too early in transition, or you give it to him too late in the shot clock, where now he's got to put it on the floor and try and create. That's not who he is. This is who he is. One dribble at the most, sidestep, corner threes, knock it down. All right, next play. I like this play here. So Kuz is going to slip. Now Miles comes over with the ghost screen, And a lot of this is just contingent upon, first of all, getting Miles's Turner's man, Dominic Barlow, right there. He follows Kuz. He comes. He helps out on Rollins. He's just caught up in a blender. And so now it gives Miles a really good angle to set that screen and to be confident that AJ's going to come off really open. So here's the screen. AJ's open. Now this closeout. Now, you know, you pick your poison. If you're a defender, you close out too shallow. It's a jumper in your face. You close out too aggressively. You get this. And AJ Chris works on this move during timeouts. Check him out sometimes on the sideline during timeouts. He'll be pantomiming this move. Shot fake, one dribble left jumper. So he can make this move in his sleep right there. Well, bip, bip, knock it down.
Yeah, it's a great move. My question, my kind of thought process, question I wanted to hear your answer on, when the Bucks do go through those sort of offensive lulls and spurts, what are some of the kind of go-to actions, some of the plays that that work very well with this group that get buckets? What are some of the go-to actions that you'd like to see the Bucks run when they do indeed get offensively stagnant?
Well, this is always, for me, and Doc has really shown a great propensity for this. When he looks at the stat sheet, Chris, at halftime, and AJ has 0 points or one field goal attempt at halftime, he will run three straight sets for AJ, whether it's the same set or maybe three different sets or whatever it is. But he's going to get him some shots. And so right now, this is great action because you got a lot of things happening. The roll by Kuz. I mean, you got the movement. It's just a thing of beauty on this possession. And this is the kind of action, the kind of movement that this team is going to have to do a whole lot more of without Giannis, because, you know, you've got to make up for no Giannis by cuts, rolls, multiple drive and kicks, second actions, force teams to have to guard you 16 to 20 seconds. And this is a perfect example of all that.
Absolutely. And to your point about movement, this is, you know, and Miles was doing this a lot. This game in particular, this looks like the Miles Turner at Indiana on offense when he'd do that corner kind of organized chaos. I wouldn't call it chaos, but look, he sets two ghost screens on one play. He engages Barlow, so Barlow can't cut out, can't close out to the shooter on the tagger. It's like, and then, but what you're saying, so while Giannis is out, Miles and Kuz, their movement, their flow, their rhythm offensively has to look like this. Miles going double screen Kuz. I would like to see him spot up, maybe go to the corner there, but he didn't. He's trying to crash the glass. That speaks to his mentality. But again, when we do go, the Bucks do go through those lows of offensive stagnation. I just want to see them get into go to high percentage sweet spot looks every time down. If you miss those, then so be it.
Yeah. Okay. So that's the good stuff. Now we're going to take a look at this not-so-good stuff that the team had some issues with. And Doc talked about the execution. Maxey has the 54 points, but this is a game that you still could have won. So this first play. So watch this play, Chris. So Kuz is going to grab this defensive rebound. Watch Barlow, number 25. Dominic Barlow goes down. So right now it's 5-on-4. Bucks do a great job, 5-on-4. And this is more props to Barlow than anything else. So now Miles is wide open. He went and sealed the smaller defender. He got himself wide open. And Ryan Rollins makes the right read trying to get it over the top. But Barlow's hustle gets him back in the play. And he's going to break this play. We may not have the final defensive play by Barlow, but Barlow right at the free throw line, that was the only thing that kept this play from being the right decision by the Bucks and by Ryan Rollins, because you had a 5-on-4.
Yeah, I also think Rollins, he kind of – gets into the habit of delivering the ball a step slow, a day late and a dollar short. Like right here is the winter pass should happen. Because you see, before the circle gets there, before he gets a foot in the paint, he actually had the lob with Miles. He throws it up to the side of the backboard. Miles catches it. That's a two-pointer.
Yeah, run it back. Let me see that. Yeah, you're right. And that's one of my issues with Ryan also. I mean, getting off the ball.
This is what we talk about him, his being a pure
Miles
point
is running,
guard.
Miles is running. He's open. Right when Ryan gets to the three-point line, he's open. You know, you got to start. Yeah, you got to start looking for him right at the three-point line.
This speaks to the larger thing about what we've been talking about with Rollins. He's a combo guard. That's running the point. And this is an evolution. Yeah. This is a growth. So, like, this is again one of those parts of his game where he holds on to it a bounce or two too long, thinking I need to get a piece of the paint.
Yeah.
But yeah. In the league, you know, he's got this pass right here.
Right.
You know what I mean? I mean, he can throw that thing up. You got who's that tagging? That's Gary's man or Greg. Who's that tagging Miles? Because it's nobody that could jump and go get it.
Quentin Grimes, I believe. But
that's Grimes.
And if
you throw that to the side of that backboard, Grimes ain't getting it. He's just fouling you on the end one.
That's a great point. Getting Barlow's out at top. Pass the five-serve for him. So no way he's going to break that up.
He's not getting that.
So it's just holding on to it, just a count too long, takes away a sure 2 points. And I think Miles committed a foul right here on Barlow, and they go down and do whatever at the free throw line. But, okay, here's the next one. Okay, Kuzma is going to miss a deep three. Now watch this. So Miles has it, swing the Kuz. Now here's what I don't like, Christian. You tell me. Right or wrong. But AJ, watch what AJ does after Kuz catches. He comes towards Kuz, brings his man with him, and there's just nowhere for Kuz to go. It's a late shot clock situation. It's it's 6 seconds on the shot clock. I thought AJ should have drifted down to the corner. Miles cut through. You know, after Miles gets rid of it, cut through AJ corner, and I open up some space for Kuz to drive. Understand your teammate. Don't cluster up this area by bringing your man up there with you. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly, MJ, but these are the type of brain farts that it's a minute 32 in the fourth. It's crunch time. Yeah. What have you always said about crunch time? You know what's are getting tight. So thought processes are now being convoluted, cloudy. I'm not thinking like I was thinking in the first quarter. I'm not saying nothing about their conditioning, but I've noticed with the Bucks in crunch time, there's a lot of this that goes on where they're not thinking in the same manner that they thought in the first and second quarter when they have that smooth flow. What you're saying, Miles, kick it, cut, AJ drop. Now Kuz has a driving lane, pump fake, one or two bounce. He could take the big 1-2, get fouled. He doesn't have to take this shot, to your point, MJ. He felt like he had nowhere to go because he saw AJ out his periphery.
Dylan, freeze it on AJ coming over where you freeze it before AJ comes.
He tried to get the ball.
So what's AJ's thought process? I'm not faulting AJ because you know, like you're saying, it's 1:32. It's a close game. It's a sense of urgency from everybody. Adrenaline is running. There's a rush. You know, thought process is a little foggy. The process is a little askew right now. But what's AJ? What's he thinking right now?
He's in between. So he's trying to go back and get the ball back. But it's like, why would you do that with 7 seconds? Yeah. You know, you pretty much only got time for one shot.
Yeah.
So that doesn't make sense. Now, for me, if AJ would have committed to a DHO, a hard cut off of this, that would have made sense. That's the only thing. Like, if Sabody had did that, I would have been happier with him doing that, because then it could have created a long three from the top for AJ to take, which is like a higher percentage shot for him than it is for Kuz.
Right.
But again, that wouldn't have been the best case scenario in that situation. But I definitely would have been happier to see something like that versus kind of handcuffing Kuz and leaving him nowhere to drive.
And that's the final point that before we go into the last clip, is that when I'm watching this, knee jerk is like, why is Kuz taking a three with 7 seconds? Why is he not putting it on the floor? Well, here's why not. Because that driving lane that he wants to go to his right is congested right now.
It's peripheral vision. He sees it.
He knows it.
If he sees that man drop down, if AJ drops to the corner and he sees that man a few more paces away from him, he's definitely trying to take that.
Yeah. So, all right, last one. Miles doesn't commit to the screen on Wallace's. So Doc talked about this last second shot in regulation. And Doc said that he wanted an ISO for Ryan Wallace, that he didn't want a screen. Miles comes over. Now, how much that impacts the final shot? You tell me. Look at it, Chris, and see if you can see what Doc was talking about in terms of giving kind of Ryan a flat 1-4, maybe just to be able to operate with a little bit more impunity out top.
I don't think there's ever a situation in which you're shooting a last second shot where you do that particular action without a freaking screen. Like, that was a ghost screen. So he's just, look, no contact. So why not nail the guy and give Rollins a little bit of daylight? I don't know. You know, I'm not sure. But last second.
It's 4 seconds. It's 4 seconds on the clock.
Four seconds or less. Like, we don't got no time to really be doing all that screening or that exchange.
Yeah.
To be honest. And that's what Doc is kind of talking about.
Right.
Get out the way. Old school. 1-4. Send everybody down. Miles, stay out the way. Yeah. Don't bring your man to the ball. That's going to
That's going to make that made Ryan Rollins root to get to his shot. He had to take that big U. Look, There's no straight line anymore. And so, you know, that's what Doc was talking about.
And to your point, so if Miles keeps Barlow away or they're all flattened out on the baseline, you know, what is Ryan Rollins' sweet spot? That little pull-up mid-range jumper. If he could get to the elbows, to the free throw, you know, that's where he wanted to go. You know, he wanted to get to that little sweet spot of his, that pull-up jumper, 17, 18 feet just inside the top of the key.
Okay. He wanted to do the exact same move that he did in the area that you're talking about. So he wanted to hit him with the step back just like he did, except a mid-ranger.
That's what he wanted.
He didn't want the big three.
Yeah, stepping back from the elbow. No reason to take the three. It's a tie ball game.
It made no sense.
All you need is two. Okay. Yeah, so Miles did kind of clutch. So that's the execution that Doc talks about, looking at it and cleaning it up. We talked to Howard Beck about this. I won't say a brutal schedule, but it's a tough schedule, man.
That's tough.
We got the Pistons on Saturday, Blazers, Heat, Knicks. Blazers are playing well. Blazers, Tiago Splitter.
You ain't got to tell me.
they beat us twice last year.
They ran us.
Avia is killing. I thought he would. I mean, I was a big fan of his, wherever he came from, D.C. or wherever he came from. Yeah. I mean, you know, he was a terrific player last year. But the Pistons, Blazers, Heat, Knicks, Nets, Wizards, and you can't sleep on anybody in this league.
Right.
But then Pistons and Sixers to end it off, to bookend it on the other side. So,
come on, man. It's going to tell us a lot. Look, it's going to tell us a lot in this gauntlet what the Bucks are truly made of. It's going to tell us a lot. And to see what type of team this is when your leader goes down and you know, this having been in the league, when you go down in the league, somebody goes down, it truly is up to the guys to earn their pay, to step up. Yeah. Like, we need guys to step up because wins are hard to come by. We've tricked off. The Bucks have tricked off so many. I'm going to say so many, but for me,
at least three. I say Houston, Sacramento, and the Sixers.
Toronto? What about Toronto?
What
about Cleveland? The Cleveland game. That first Cleveland game. They tricked that off, in my opinion. Yeah. I thought we had them. But anyway, but MJ, like I'm saying, the Bucks could easily be, what's that?
So that's 11-5.
The Bucks could easily be 11-5. And I think that's the silver lining in all this stuff, is despite being down guys, despite the inconsistent rotation and then the offensive struggles and then the defensive stuff, they're still in a position to where they can make a run. And they can make. So this gauntlet is going to be very important. I think it's going to be most important, though, in building confidence for when Giannis does come back. So I hope the guys do take advantage of these opportunities to really get their, you know, to really sharpen up on their execution. For me, the Bucks' number one thing is execution.
Yeah.
In the game, in the quarter, in the shot clock, whatever, ATO, out of bounds. It's all about them winning those battles and having an advantage in every one of those situations.
Yeah, well, that's why they call it the Fantastic Voyage. And we will see just kind of where we are when we reconvene. But it's going to be a gauntlet. It's going to be a tough test. And as Doc Rivers keeps saying, there's a silver lining, and hopefully that silver lining. And there's a lot of potential ways that silver lining could manifest itself, you know, between Cole Anthony, between Bobby Portis, had a great game against the Sixers, 19 points. Kyle Kuzma continuing. Miles Turner shooting 43% right now. You know, Gary Trent, I think, is a guy that he can lift his game up to another level. So
he's due.
Yeah, so we'll see. But anyway, man, great show today. Howard Beck, again, thank him. Here, District. Fantastic boy. It's a captain. First mate, Chris Johnson. We out of here.